Menards' 11% rebate is here. From lighting to lumber, from doors to floors, the bigger the project, the bigger the rebate. From painting projects to that new kitchen makeover and designing that outdoor space of your dreams, save big on any project you're tackling. Hurry into Menards for an 11% rebate on everything. Mail-in rebate is a merchandise credit check, not a point-of-sale discount. Redeemable on future in-store purchases only. Not on future purchases on Menards.com. See store for details.
Save big money at Menards.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas. Wow, I have waited a long time to say this. Lock and Rose, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks for having me on. Sorry I took forever to get back to you.
Well, it's fine. It gave me an opportunity to read your book 500 million times.
Good. It's always good.
I suppose a good starting point is let's talk about your background first, and then it'll lead up to our conversation.
Sure. I was, as you can probably tell by how I talk, born and raised in the U.S. and, of course, subjected to the usual patriotic, nationalist, statist propaganda that almost everybody in every country is to one degree, but the U.S. seems to be rather more nationalist than most places. Grew up believing in the Constitution and limited government and sort of a conservative leaning, that sort of thing. But I liked to debate and I liked to argue. And almost everybody I talked to wanted more government than I wanted. Like they wanted a bunch of collectivist stuff, and whether it's a welfare state or whatever. So I would argue with them and feel like, ha ha ha, I totally won that argument. But there kept being this thing in the back of my head sort of nagging at me that I would notice contradictions in my own belief system. So unlike most of the people I know who now believe as I do, it wasn't somebody dragging me in that direction. It was arguing against people in the other direction who wanted more authoritarianism. But noticing little things about my own position, like if I debate, I don't want to have to debate from a position that contradicts itself, because you tend to trip over yourself and make a fool of yourself. And so just trying to be consistent, I would notice that, like, I'm complaining if somebody else is saying, well, we have the right to tax the hell out of you to fund some giant welfare state. And I would argue, no, you don't. Like, what I earn belongs to me. If I choose to help somebody else, that's fine. You don't get to help somebody else with my money against my will. That's not okay. That's not moral. That's not legitimate. And then in the back of my head, there'd be this little nagging thing that said, yeah, but you believe in taxation to like fund the military and the police. What if they don't want to fund that? Like, why is it okay for me to have them forced to fund what I want, but it's not okay when they do it to me? So along the line, I basically whittled down the government I believed in, which to begin with was already smaller than what almost anybody else wanted, because the Constitution describes a pretty tiny government. And I whittled it down more and more until I realized to be legitimate and moral and righteous and something that should exist, it isn't government anymore. It's just people doing what people have the right to do. It has no special rights. It has no monopoly on anything. Like, people have the right to protect themselves and protect each other and cooperate to protect against thugs or cooperate to help the poor or, you know, a million different problems that we can handle voluntarily. And government says, well, give us power and we'll come along and take everybody's money by force. And then we'll help the poor and protect you from thieves other than ourselves, because we steal more than anybody else, but we'll protect you from other thieves. So I accidentally fell off the political spectrum entirely and realized I can't condone government because government can't ever be moral and legitimate. So I sort of accidentally fell backwards into being an anarchist. That's the scary word for it. It doesn't mean Molotov cocktail throwing idiots. It literally means rule by no one. Not having a ruling class. It doesn't mean no cooperation. It doesn't mean no organization. It doesn't mean every man for himself. It literally means we don't have rulers. We act like grownups. We interact, we cooperate in 1,000 different ways, but none of those ways are I get to violently dominate you or you get to violently dominate me. And so I just fell into it accidentally just by trying to remove contradictions from my own position. And that was 28 years ago now. It was 96. And the reason I remember that is because in AOL chat rooms, I remember my handle. It was Ragnar1996. And that's when I all the way gave up the last little shred of belief in political power at all, which was, you know, weird, uncomfortable.
Did you say your handle was Ragnar, as in the Viking?
As in Ragnar Danishold. It's from Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand.
Well, you've got that sort of blonde Viking look going, so I thought maybe.
I think I'm just British. Oh, I did find out I have some Scottish in there, so there may be some like William Wallace hanging around in there somewhere.
Your work was obviously, in my view, quite reminiscent of the work of others like Hayek, which I've read, and Mises, and that Austrian school. But I think you're a bit more disconnected from that in the sense that they still see, to some degree, a reason to have government.
Right. And the main difference, and the thing is, I was where they were for years. I don't even like to admit how long it took me to give up that last little bit. In fact, Ayn Rand, who wrote the book that my name was after on AOL, she never gave it up either, because there's this desire, and it's totally understandable. Like, I don't condemn people for having this desire. We want an all-powerful good guy to make sure the innocent are protected. We want there to be this big, powerful thing that nothing can overcome, and it makes sure that innocent people are protected and taken care of, and the bad guys are stopped, and yada, yada, yada. Basically, they imagine this mythical deity called government that's going to be better than human beings and more effective than human beings, even though it's made up of not only human beings, but pretty much the worst human beings there are. So the desire to have some big, all-powerful institution that protects the innocent, yeah, if there could be such a thing, that would be awesome. Government is not that. Government is the exact opposite of that. But it's when people are trained from childhood to think that, well, government is the thing that keeps order, and it's the thing that protects us, and it's the thing that makes civilization possible, and, you know, all the fun mythology we're taught about it. When somebody has been subjected to those ideas their whole life, the idea of not having government to them sounds like not having order, not having protection. Everything's just chaos and mayhem and violence and all that stuff. So when somebody first hears about the idea of not having a ruling class or a government, it sounds scary. And it sounds like, well, you must not believe in right and wrong, because that's just going to be every man for himself. And it's ironic that it really is the exact opposite. Because theft is wrong, it's also wrong when government does it. Because initiating violence against somebody who didn't threaten or harm anybody, because that's wrong, it's still wrong, even when it's done in the name of law and taxes, and it's done by lawmakers and their enforcers. And to me, the most sort of ironic thing is, you know, almost everything I do now is focused on trying to get other people to give up their belief in political authority. But none of that is about me telling somebody else to adopt my moral code and my standards, because why on earth would they? like why should some random person who hasn't heard of me decide, well, I'm just going to toss my own, you know, like moral ideas of right and wrong out the window and believe this guy? Literally what I do is try to convince people to actually adhere to their own moral code. And that's it. Not to adopt mine, because they have no reason to do that. Apply your own moral code and apply it to everybody. And that's all, because when somebody goes through the process to learn what government actually is, they come to the unavoidable realization, every advocate of government, every single one, and this was true of me back when I believed in government, every advocate of government is betraying his own moral beliefs. You can't not. There's no option. It's not just that government tends to be corrupt, or sometimes it does bad things. It's that when you're advocating an authoritarian ruling class, you are going against what you know to be right. what you know is the way human beings should behave. You've just been taught that there's an exemption for the people in this weird monstrosity called government. They're allowed to tax. They're allowed to legislate in all sorts of arbitrary, random ways and tell people what they can smoke and what they can build and who they can hire and everything under the sun. So weirdly to me, I'm not trying to like convert anybody from their belief to my belief. I'm just trying to get them to embrace what they actually believe in over sort of the layer of authoritarian status garbage they were taught that conflicts with what they as an individual actually believe in, unless somebody's like all the way a sociopath.
What I found fascinating about your book, and I've picked it up now in the conversation, you're using terminology like belief and mythology. And I guess that ties into why you refer to government, government as the most dangerous superstition. You've created this parallel between government and a cult.
And that's one of the hardest things for people, again, it was true of me too. It's one of the hardest things for people to realize. The difference between what most people call their God and what most people call government is that most people actually believe in government and they don't really believe in what they call God. And when a belief is so entrenched and so deeply rooted in somebody's psyche that they don't even recognize it as a belief, they just think, well, that's just what is, duh. Everybody knows, like, this is the political system we have, and you have constitutions, and you vote, and you do this, and the lawmakers pass laws, and the enforcement, like, that's just, that's how it is. That's how it has to be. That's how it's always been. That's how it will always be. And if somebody just thinks, well, that's just reality, like, I would compare it to, you know, sometimes I use the example of some primitive tribe somewhere that, like, lives in the shadow of a volcano, and they think there's the god of the volcano, and they like throw human sacrifices in it to appease the gods. And if somebody comes along and says, that's not, there's no god in there, that's like molten rock, and it's, we could explain how that works. It isn't a god. What do you mean it isn't a god? We can see it. We can hear it. Of course it's a god. If somebody can't even recognize something as a belief, it never occurs to them to doubt it. They just think, well, government just is. And so one of the main ways I get people to see that is just asking them questions about, okay, so there's this thing called government and it's legitimate and it has the right to like pass laws and stuff. Is there ever a time when its laws are illegitimate? Like, you know, in the US, slavery used to be legal. In fact, all over the world at one point or another, slavery was legal. In that case, were people obligated to obey? And almost everybody says, well, no, in that case, that's horrible. The law was wrong and they should disobey. It's like, okay, now we're getting somewhere because you just decided that your own moral conscience matters more than those laws passed by lawmakers through their legal system and enforced by law enforcers. Well, who are you to decide that your conscience outranks what the lawmakers have decreed? And that, it's literally the difference between being a robot and a human. If you think you have to do what somebody else said, and never mind whether it's right or wrong, never mind using your own conscience or judgment, you're just somebody else's robot. But if you're at least capable of saying, well, if they say something too bad, I'm not going to obey. Okay, that's a trace of your humanity. The part of you that knows right and wrong and knows that politician scribbles can't really just make that disappear. And that battle inside the minds of, you know, billions of human beings, that is the battle that matters. It's not who sits on the throne in any ruling class. It's how long are the people going to imagine an obligation to obey the worst people in the world? That's what almost everything I do is now focused on, is helping people escape the thing that's keeping them from being themselves and keeping them from doing what they already know is right.
The Jones Plantation. Excuse me.
Exactly. As you may see on the screen behind me. And it's funny because things like Jones Plantation movie, it doesn't even explain what's supposed to be. It shows people what is and what is definitely not supposed to be, just to make them uncomfortable, just to make them back up and doubt and go, yeah, wait a minute, this has a lot of similarities to what we see on a daily basis. Because when something is a deep belief rather than a logical conclusion, it's really uncomfortable for most people to actually question it or look at it.
You're kind of describing a type of mental enslavement that people impose on themselves without even realizing it.
Yeah, they're accomplices to their own enslavement. Now, there's lots of indoctrination and propaganda and stuff designed to do that, but then they pass it on. There's actually, I made a novel version of Jones Plantation to fit into it all the things that didn't fit in a movie. And one of the things that Mr. Smith talks about in the novel version that there wasn't time for in the movie is how the human livestock, everybody who pays tribute to government and obeys it, they basically help enslave each other by condemning anyone. You broke the law. Well, did the person hurt anybody or did they just disobey some arbitrary thing that was immoral to begin with? Like, oh, you smoked the wrong plant or something, and the politician said you're not allowed to. Really? You think that's some horrible sin because some politician somewhere said not to do that? And so that's the battle, is between whether people, because just other than sociopaths, almost everybody realizes it's not okay to like violently attack people and steal their stuff. Like, this is pretty basic being a human being.
But adding to what you're saying, COVID era should be the most premium example of what happens when the state, the government, well, we'll actually talk about the differences in terminology, I suppose, in a moment, but the government has so much authority and so much power that it can lock down the entire world using its own police and military, which nobody can stand up against.
Well, but first of all, yes, I agree. But people can absolutely stand up against it if the numbers game is in the right direction.
Yes.
And it was interesting. A lot of people, like, they saw that whole ridiculous circus and said, well, you know, now we're doomed. Like, everyone is now completely brainwashed. And I basically said, well, they already were. It was just harder to tell before. Like, now they're literally wearing it on their face, how brainwashed they were. They already were to that level. At the same time, there were a lot of people who learned how to say no. And I was in Arizona for all that, and it was fun how many people around here. To begin with, everyone's scared, and it's like, well, we better go along with it because we might all die. We might kill grandma or whatever. And 5 seconds later, a lot of people are like, okay, this is overblown, at least. This is ridiculous. What's going on? And it didn't take long before a bunch of people were just saying, yeah, we're not shutting down. And then more than one county sheriff in Arizona came out and said, we're not enforcing this. So the governor is saying, we're shutting these down and you have to wear masks. And the sheriff's, the top enforcer in the county, is coming out and saying, no, we're not doing this. This is stupid. He has no authority to do that. And we're not going to make you do it. So who cares what he says? And so even among their own enforcers, there were people disobeying and resisting. And then there were tons of normal people saying, we're not going to shut our businesses down. We're just We need to feed our families, and you telling us to shut down, we're just not doing that. And so it was sort of a test of at what point are people going to obey just stupid garbage to their own detriment? And a lot of people did. And even in the U.S., it was very different in different places. Like, New York basically committed suicide by being ridiculous about their compliance. Most people, a bunch of people just left New York, and a bunch of people left California because they were the most sort of compliant, bootlicking authoritarian states.
What's funny, though, is you're dead right. I mean, if I looked, I don't have the exact numbers, but I think I remember reading something along the lines of legal gun ownership just in Texas, I think, is way larger than the entire U.S. military. Here in South Africa, for example, we've got, I don't know, 2 to 2.5 million legal gun owners. And I think our police force is only 200,000 or something. And if you want to add a few extra thousand in terms of military to that, just private citizens can completely outnumber the state, but they don't realize it.
Yeah, there are over 100 million gun owners in the U.S., private gun owners. And they own, on average, 3 guns each. So there are more privately owned firearms than there are people here. That's one of the reasons I'm still here. Now, you also need the mentality to disobey, but having the machinery to disobey helps. And in Arizona, you don't need this was a recent thing. You used to need like a carry permit to carry concealed or open. Now, if you're an adult and you're not a convicted felon, you can carry open or concealed anywhere in Arizona without anybody's permission, which makes crime rates go down, not up, because the criminals know, yeah, any given target may fight back. It also makes government agents know, like when the sheriffs were saying, we're not doing this, one of the reasons they even gave was, why would we put our deputies in danger trying to enforce this stupid thing that's illegitimate to begin with? In other words, they're saying the people might shoot us if we do this, so we don't really want to do this. Thank you very much. And we don't think the governor had the right to do that anyway. The first book I wrote is called, it's actually out of print at the moment, How to Be a Successful Tyrant. It was written as a manual, as if someone's trying to be a tyrant. I mean, it's flippant, obviously, but it does describe what they actually do. And if you're the tyrant at the top and you're like, you will do this and you will shut down, and your own enforcers turn around and go, yeah, we're not doing that. Like, you're in trouble. Now you're just you. Now you're just some power happy psycho and nobody's obeying you. So the fact that they pushed it so hard that even a bunch of their own enforcers disobeyed, and tons of, in different people, in different places, it was different, you know, percentages. But in Arizona, a whole lot of people said, we're not doing that. In Yavapai County, that's just north of Phoenix, a ton of people said, we're not doing the mask thing. We're not doing the shutdowns. And immediately they become unenforceable. So in Phoenix, for a while, you still saw a bunch of people, you know, businesses shut down and people wearing masks, and you go up to Yavapai and there's almost none of that, because the beauty is, you know, even though we absolutely have the machinery to forcibly resist, when enough people disobey, you don't have to, because those in government know we don't want to pick a fight we're going to lose. And if the people, if enough of the people, doesn't even have to be a majority, if a big enough percentage of the people say, we're not going along with this and you do not want to try to force us to, because bad things will happen, that's the only time government backs off. They don't care about protests. They don't care about petitions. They don't care about elections. They do care about it when they look out and go, yeah, lots of the peasantry isn't putting up with our crap today. And if we try to force it on them, there's going to be a backlash and it's going to get ugly real fast and we're going to lose because they outgun us by a huge margin. And so just the mental ability to say no is the thing that matters most.
When you spoke now about your first book, you reminded me of a book that I've got here somewhere called The Anarchist's Cookbook. I think you might know it. And it very casually tells you how to make a bomb at home, you know. but it starts off by saying, we don't recommend you try this at home, but if you really wanted to, yes, what you do.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. I don't even have that book, so I don't count as a real anarchist.
No, well, it's constantly being censored and banned.
Yeah, there's that too. There's a thing called if you ever doubt that, like, the people's ability to resist government, there's a thing that happens every year in Arizona called, I think it's just the Big Sandy Shoot. And people from all over the state, probably all over the country, come with their privately owned weapons. And there's just this giant hillside and they put targets out and they have, like, drones flying around to shoot at. And you have people with just machine guns and anti-aircraft guns and like a tank. And it's like, they just go out and have a grand old time blasting the hell out of the side of the mountain. Yeah, literally a tank. And
that's amazing.
And so if one of the things people often talk about is, we need a government to protect from invasion. It's like, no, we don't. Like, our government military is already outgunned by just our population. And there's that famous quote by Admiral something or other from Japan, who was asked in World War II, like, did you ever consider a land invasion invading California or something? And he was like, no, there'd be a gun behind every blade of grass. Like, yeah. We'd have, like, not their military, just the people there. We'd have no prayer in hell of doing anything. And that's actually the ultimate form of large scale defense, is just an armed population, even if they're not organized. Like, I'm not against them being organized and prepared, but even just random people having tons of guns. Like, I don't care what army you give me. I don't want to invade Arizona, even just Arizona, because I know what some of these people have and what I have, for that matter. But the idea that government always pushes is that you can't defend yourself or each other. That's why you need us. And you need to give us a gajillion dollars and tons of power. And you can't help the poor. That's why you need us to take tons of money from you. And so it really is a matter of keeping people childish in their mentality. Like, don't think like a grown-up, like, It's up to us to figure out how to handle things. Think like a child and beg government to protect you and feed you and house you and do all that stuff. It's just a question of, do you want to grow up or not? And to me, all the way, and this may sound a little condescending, all the way growing up requires being a voluntarist and an anarchist, because it requires you figuring out, if there's a conflict between the law and my conscience, why on earth would I defer to a bunch of political parasites instead of doing what I know to be right? It kind of just boils down to that.
More technically, when we talk about government, what are we actually talking about? And perhaps throw in the word state.
Government means the exercise of authority over a people or place. In the political sense, it's a ruling class. And these days, they don't refer to themselves as a ruling class. No, we're a representative republic, like, of constitutionally based blah, 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 lots of blah, blah, blah to hide the fact that it's a ruling class. It tells you what to do and it steps on you if you disobey. But authority is the key to it, because authority means the right to rule, not just the ability. Like, any carjacker with a gun might have the ability to rule over somebody and steal their stuff and steal their car or whatever. The concept of the right to rule, that is the heart, and that's what the most dangerous superstition is. It's the belief that authority is actually a thing. So when people refer to the state, as in the government, the ruling class, as in the big gang with guns over there, that's a real thing. But since government means the thing that has the right to do that, your rightful lords and masters, that isn't the thing. That's not real. Their guns are real. The people are real. The thuggery is real. Their violence is real. Their right to do any of it isn't. Their authority isn't real. And they're only able to pull these things off because the vast majority of their victims imagine that they have the right to. And it's so ironic that a lot of people think, well, if we do away with government, like, warlords will spring up. Like, first of all, we already have warlords. They're called government. Second of all, the only reason, especially somewhere like the U.S. that is so heavily armed, the only reason that particular gang of parasites is able to rob us and dominate us is because most of the victims feel obligated to let them. I've said before, like, if China invaded the U.S., zero people in the country would think, well, we have an obligation to bow to these foreign invaders, and everybody would shoot them and they'd leave. But when Americans rule them and rob them and say, well, this is our constitutional republic, blah, 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 they go, oh, well, I'm a law-abiding taxpayer. I will do as I'm told. That's the difference. You think you're supposed to go along with one set of crooks, and you don't think you're supposed to go along with the other set of crooks. The ones that you think you're supposed to pay tribute to and pay taxes to and obey, they have infinitely more power than any invading army ever would, because nobody would feel obligated to obey. Everybody would feel justified in, like, oh, here comes some random army from some random country. Let's shoot at them. Like, that's what everybody would do, instead of, well, I'm proud to pay my taxes and obey the law. I'm proud to be subjugated by that group of crooks over there because they say they represent me and I've consented to this. And so people underestimate how much the belief is what enables oppression and authoritarianism. It isn't their guns. It isn't their, you know, their tanks or bombers. And people have said that before. Look at all the guns they have. I don't care how many guns they have. I care how many trigger fingers they have. And even that depends on the belief of the people wearing the uniform for them. So, like, in the example of the sheriff, when the enforcers of the state go, this is wrong, we're not going to do this anymore, then it's just gone. There's nothing to fight against. Like, the people who would have been the enforcers, you know, got a conscience and said, let's not do this anymore. Just quit. And it just evaporates, because without that belief in, like, well, I'm enforcing the law because, like, I'm just following orders, I'm just doing as I'm told. Without lots of people doing that because they think government's legitimate, none of the tyrants have any power. Like, you might find a few sociopaths who will work for you and do evil things knowing they're evil for a paycheck, but they're not going to want to die for it. And if they know their victims are heavily armed, they're going to quit too. Not because they're good people, just because they don't want to choose to die horribly trying to victimize people who they know are going to shoot them. And so the mentality is the source of all of government's power. And it's something that people don't recognize until they're outside of that belief system. And they realize, oh, wow, I was empowering. When I thought it was good to pay your taxes and obey the law, I was empowering the worst people in the world, too. I was talking as if they have the right to do this, and as if anybody who disobeys or doesn't pay their fair share, as if they're the bad guys. Like, as if the slaves who disobey the master, well, they're the ones we should really hate. Well, how about not liking the master instead? Why are you turning on your fellow victim? That's what the belief in government does, is it makes normal people cheer for their own enslavement and the enslavement of everybody around them, thinking they're being good, law-abiding taxpayers. And it's weird to watch.
An example of that, again, was during the COVID era where people were reporting their neighbors for walking their dog.
Yeah, just ridiculously heinous stuff. And I did a video called Never Forget. I think it's still on YouTube. Surprisingly, they haven't taken that one down yet. Because a lot of people, if you bring up something like Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia or something, almost everybody wants to imagine, well, if I was there, I'd be part of the resistance and I'd be the good guys fighting against. And it's like, would you though? Because when it really happens in real life here and people are authoritarians, lots of people go on their little power trip. Like, yeah. I wear my mask and I'm staying at home and I'm going to report anybody who doesn't and feel my little bit of power that I get from the ruling class. It's like, yeah, that's your potential little brown shirt Nazi shining through, that if you had the chance to have power over others, even if it's just squealing on them, you would take it because you're not really that good a person. And if you were in Soviet Russia or Nazi Germany, you'd be working for the wrong side. But even that is because they believe in authority. Because the number of people who would, like, rob me on their own to give to the poor is really, really tiny if it's above zero. The number of people who will vote to have government rob me so that they can pretend, well, I'm compassionate because I voted to have those guys rob these guys to give to the poor, is huge, because they think that legal authority makes that okay and righteous. And so even the ones, like, who's going to squeal on their neighbor? I see someone walking their dog without permission. Like, if there's no authority saying anything about that, everyone else would go, okay, fine, mind your business. Like, what are you talking about?
I was asking about the word state, but I think it's rather academic and probably pointless. It's essentially the same thing with a few differences around the edges. And I think when we talk about government and the state, for the purposes of this conversation, it's essentially the same thing.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same thing. State doesn't necessarily imply authority, but yeah, at the end of the day, they're almost the same. But government, very much, the definition includes authority. That's what distinguishes it from any other just violent gang, is, oh, they're the ones that have a right to be a violent gang.
I'm asking about terminology and what we mean when we say these things. For example, I stay in a gated community, in a state or whatever you want to call it. And we have, let's say, some people that represent the homeowners. Is that government?
It's funny because HOAs, I don't know if they're called that now, homeowners associations, because people are so used to thinking in the sort of the mindset of government, they often turn into their own version of these little fiefdoms where it's like, well, if you're going to live here, if you're going to buy property in here or rent in here or whatever it is, then you agree to abide by these rules, which, by the way, we might change whenever we feel like it. And so it sort of turns into a mini version. And you can sort of say, well, it's voluntary because you didn't have to go into that particular place. So it's sort of this halfway in between weird mangling. The thing is, if people weren't so accustomed to thinking in the statist mindset, almost nobody would agree to, like, why would I agree to abide by rules you haven't even written yet? It's one thing if you, like, okay, I'm going to buy this knowing that, you know, we're quiet after 10 p.m. and we don't, you know, whatever the rules are. But why would you agree to follow rules from people who can just change them ahead of time? And I think people are so used to government that they just naturally, oh, okay, I guess I'll agree and see what random stuff you make up next week, instead of saying, it's like, why would I sign a contract when I don't even know what I'm agreeing to yet? And the thing is, as one person who understands that, it doesn't help much, because all the HOAs are, you know, mostly people who don't think in those terms. And so they agree ahead of time to rules that they haven't even decided on. And so it's sort of a mini morphed, mangled version, like halfway in between voluntary, because you can totally have voluntary agreements that, like, all right, I'm only going to sell my house to somebody who agrees to whatever because he's going to be my neighbor. But yeah, HOAs very quickly can sort of fall into the pattern of, now we can make up any rules we want.
It gets a bit murky sometimes when you start talking about borders, because I suspect if it's your own property, then what's around it is your border, and that's okay. But when you're talking about borders, you're largely talking about that the government controls.
Yeah. And that's one of the biggest things that people have a hard time giving up, is the notion of border control. I recently just did a video about that, pointing out that conservatives in the U.S. who like rant on and on about, we have the right to own guns, which we do, and nobody can take that away. And then they say, but we need strong border controls. And they say, where in the Constitution does it say the government has the right to do that? Because it doesn't. There's no such thing. But when people think in terms of the collective, as if there's some politicians over in D.C. that own this half a continent, and they get to decide who can be here, that's one more excuse for authoritarian power. I don't own a half a continent. You know, I own the property I own. I get to decide who can be on my property. I don't get to decide who can be in like Alaska or Florida or Hawaii, because those aren't mine. But people are usually easy to trick into the collective thinking, the collectivist thinking, that, well, governments have the right to decide who can set foot anywhere inside this gigantic area known as the United States, and use force to keep people out if they don't have the permission of politicians to be here. And that's completely bogus and illegitimate. But it's so easy, if people are thinking in the collective mindset, to be scared and say, well, what if a bunch of scary people come in? Yeah, that would be a scary thing. And you have the right to keep all of them off of your property. And there are so many ways in which government scares people into cheering for a lack of freedom. And the border thing is definitely one. It's one of the big ones that conservatives in the U.S. harp on. We need a wall and we need more authoritarian power. And then the left are like, well, we're all going to get shot unless we ban guns. And we're all going to be like starving unless we have a giant welfare state. So there's this never ending stream of excuses for those in power to say, this is why you need to give us power, because scary, horrible things will happen if you don't. And then they intentionally make those scary things happen. Like here with the immigration, like, illegal immigration to me doesn't mean anything. Like, okay, you didn't have a politician's permission to step across some arbitrary line. Okay, I don't care. To me, that isn't a bad thing in any way. But if somebody comes across and victimizes somebody else, which happens, they'll say, see, this is why we need to build a big wall. And like, how about instead we defend ourselves against the actual aggressors? And if somebody does that, like, we do something about that guy. Like, I don't care that he walked across some line. I care that he attacked somebody. And I'm all in favor of all the way the use of deadly force. If somebody's physically assaulting you and the way to stop them is make them stop being alive, then do that. That's the purpose of normal people being armed.
So I mean, that
government can.
Sorry, I interrupted, but that's effectively a solution for what's happening in Europe. Just get guns and start shooting the bad people.
Absolutely. And notice, why can people not do that? Because government disarmed them. So government creates a problem, makes people helpless, then creates another problem. You go, see, this is why we need more power. Because now, while you're being disarmed and helpless, you're being overrun by these scary people and you can't do anything about it. You better give us lots of money and power. And they do that in every single, and my first book, How to Be a Successful Tyrant, talks about a whole bunch of them. Things to be feared is what government specializes in. And they're very good at making a problem, scaring everybody with it, and then saying that more power for them is the solution, as if that ever works anyway. And it's very easy. Like, if you let people be free, these problems handle themselves. There's one place in, I think it was Georgia, there was some county, and I don't even agree with this, because the law literally required people to have a gun in their homes. It's like, if you're of sound mind, you're gonna have a private firearm. And I don't believe in forcing anybody to do that. I think it's a good thing for people to have. I wouldn't force it. And crime just vanished. Like, overnight, it just vanished, because all the criminals know, wow, they just told everybody you have to have the ability to shoot intruders. Like, if you're an intruder, that's not a good place to be. Go somewhere else. And so that mentality and that approach of people thinking like grownups is like, okay, there are some bad people out there, whether they were born in this country or some other country. Like, I don't really care. There's bad people out there. We, as the responsible, moral grownups, we better be able to do something about it. And that's why I own firearms. Mm-hmm. I don't hunt. I know a lot of people who do, but I don't hunt. I own firearms, so I have the ability to kill people, which I very much hope I never have to use. But if the grown-ups don't have that ability, then they're just sitting ducks and victims waiting to happen for anybody who wants to come along, whether it's a private thug or government oppression or anything else. But it's one more way in which government trains people to be children. You can't be trusted with weapons. Leave that to the authorities. Oh, look at all this crime going on. Golly gee, better give us more power since we disarmed you and didn't stop all the crime after we disarmed you. So it's the cycle they always do. And a lot of people still fall for it. Well, we better give them even more money and more power to protect us.
I suppose I should ask you the question, do you walk the talk?
To some degree. Now, that's it's funny because I was just writing a script for a video I'm going to do. Everybody sort of has to decide for themselves to what degree they're going to disobey. And I compare it to, like, if somebody lives in a city where, the mafia is in control or, like, organized crime, if they decide, well, I'm going to pay them their protection racket fees so they don't break my kneecaps, like, that doesn't make that person pro-mafia or pro-extortion. It just means, okay, for some of it, I'm going to go along with it, even though it's illegitimate because I don't want to get killed. And so I don't tell anybody where their line should be to disobey. If they're not advocating authoritarianism, but they go along with a bunch, like having a driver's license or,
paying taxes,
a carry permit or paying taxes. And I did have my own adventures with the federal extortion racket, which ended with me in a cage for a year. That wasn't even like a philosophical protest. That was just, they also lie about what their own laws say. But that's a different story. If anybody wants it, they can email me at larkin@larkinrose.com and I'll send you a PDF of the whole ridiculous story. But I know a bunch of people who say, yeah, I'm not going to fund them at all. I'm not going to go along. I'm not going to get a driver's license. And it's like, okay, you absolutely are justified in refusing to go along with their crap. It may not go well for you because at the moment they still have lots of enforcers. And so I also know a bunch of people who like, well, I'm going to pay these stupid bogus taxes and I'm going to get a driver's license. I'm going to jump through their dumb hoops and I'm not going to build something without getting a permit first because they're going to be a pain in my butt if they do. So sort of the degree to which somebody decides to sort of either martyr themselves or go to battle, to me, that's always a personal thing. I'm not going to tell somebody like, you have to go stick your neck on the line. The thing that matters to me is, are you out there advocating that this be done to people? Because if you're out there going, rah, 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 hooray, I love the mafia, okay, then you suck. If you're just paying them to keep your kneecaps from being smashed, okay, I can understand that. And the thing is, when enough people give up the belief in authority, resisting and disobeying them becomes really easy. If there's a few people disobeying, yeah, they can send in their thugs and make an example of here's what happens. If 50 million people say, we're done with this, we're not playing your game anymore, there isn't even a revolution. There's just because the government doesn't nearly have the resources to do anything and they have to back off. So that's why what people believe is the thing that matters. If people stop believing in an obligation to obey, when enough people stop believing that, any empire falls over. I don't care how many tanks and planes you have. If your subjects feel no obligation to obey you and would feel perfectly justified doing nasty things to you when you look the other way, your empire's just doomed. Even if some people, like for now, will go along because they're scared. And that's why I don't focus on, we need an uprising. And no, we need people to stop believing they're obligated to bow to these crooks. And that's it. And the rest takes care of itself.
Larkin, is there not a sense of hubris, too much self-importance when we talk about authority? For example, if you're a Christian, you do have an authority, but it's a spiritual one. How does that come into play?
It's funny because I think even religious people, like I don't identify as a Christian. I was raised as a Christian, but I know tons of Christian anarchists. And when somebody believes in, whatever God it is, Christian or otherwise, one of the first questions I usually ask them is, which of these descriptions more closely fits the deity that you believe in? It says, you do what I say or I punish you, or it's a loving guide telling you how to live a life that will have you be fulfilled and happy and content. In other words, is it just somebody bossing you around and kicking you if you disobey, or is it somebody telling you that this is the way to be what you're supposed to be? And even in the past, you know, couple of decades, I've seen a big shift away from sort of the view of the authoritarian God that you're going to do it because I'll hurt you if you don't, to no, it's what we're supposed to be. It's what actually makes us fulfilled and whole and content and happy and all that. So it's a guide instead of a bossy control freak. Now, there are people who believe in bossy control freak. The thing is, if they believe that about themselves, okay, if they're not inflicting it on everybody else, I don't care. It used to be the churches were the ruling classes that would go around, oh, you don't believe the right God? Well, we're going to torture you and kill you. In that situation, they were the government. It just had, it used different words, but they were the authoritarian ruling class. And often, like, you go back to British stuff, it was like the church and the king, and they work together and they sort of share power. So that's all authoritarian garbage. Now, in most places, at least in most Western places, people aren't trying to force their religious views on other people, except by way of government. If government says, hey, elect me, and I'll use government to force, but they don't just go around saying, well, I think drinking is a sin, so I'm going to hit you with this rock or something. Most people aren't doing that anymore. So most of their authoritarianism isn't coming from their religious beliefs, but it is coming from their political beliefs. And that's, it was a few hundred years ago when a whole lot of violent authoritarianism was coming directly from churches and religious beliefs. And there is still some in the Middle East and stuff like that, where people will use violence in the name of their God directly. But most people, the God they actually believe in now, they call government, and they don't recognize as a God, but that's the authoritarian monster they support.
What about in the home? I mean, you, as a father, you know better than your child.
Yeah, and that's, I actually have a daughter. She's now grown up. My first wife and I were anarchists by the time she was born, which was interesting. There's a big difference between, basically, we're stewards of her. Like, okay, you're this tiny little person. You don't know how to do anything. You don't know anything. If we left it up to you, you would eat cake all day and then throw up and be sick. So we're going to control you for your own good. You don't have to like it. You don't have to agree with it. And you don't have to view us as having the right to do that. So there's this concept of incompetence, not E-N-C-E, like E-N-T-S, the people who are incompetent to run their own lives, which at this point is most of humanity, but that's not what I'm talking about. But the people who can't make their own decisions because they don't know enough. To me, the ultimate measure of what a parent should do is if you could interview the child like 20 years in the future and say, what should we have done about, like, you wanted to eat this huge box of cookies. Should we have let you? And they'll probably go, no. Like, when they have all the information and know what's going on, they'll go, yeah.
They'll say yes.
Cookies so always win.
Yeah, go for cookies. And if they say go for cookies, okay, I guess that's what we should have done. But the mindset of we're in charge of this little human that doesn't know what they're doing. They don't know anything. They have no skills. They have no ability to feed themselves. Like, human beings are one of the most helpless creatures there is when we're born. Most things can, like a horse is walking around 10 minutes later. We're not walking around for years. So we have this little helpless, incompetent thing, and it's sort of our job to do our best to help it and help it become like a self-owning human being. Just that attitude is very different than, well, I'm the parent, so you do what I say, no matter what it is. Like the whole, because I said so. Like, that's not a good reason.
So what you're saying, like, is that it's all about a mindset.
Yeah, very much so. And if you even view little kids as if, you know, that this little newborn baby, I was there when my daughter was born, like, they don't know anything, they can't do anything, but they're going to end up owning themselves. She belongs to herself. Right now, she's ill-equipped to do anything about it. So it's our job to take care of her until she's in a position to take care of herself. It's not our job to rule her. She's not our property. She's not our possession. She's not a thing to be owned. She's a human being who can't take care of herself mentally or physically right now. You can compare it to, well, there's a bunch of analogies that could be used, but if somebody is like mentally retarded to a degree they can't take care of themselves, You don't just go, ah, well, then we can enslave them and torture them and kill them and do whatever. No, you take care of them in doing the things they can't. And to some degree, that means making choices for them and not letting them, like, wander into the street. If I see somebody wandering into the street by accident, I will impose my will on them and pull them out of the street before they get run over. It's not because I'm your authority and I get to tell you what to do. It's because I'm pretty sure for your own benefit, you don't really want to get run over. And so it really is, it's coming from a place of, I'm trying to serve your interests, but you don't have to feel beholden to me. You don't have to look at me as something you have to obey. When you're little enough, you don't have a choice. You don't have to like it and you don't have to understand it. I think as soon as parents can explain the reasons for the things they do, it's good to do that. So it isn't just, we're just randomly making you do stuff and you have no idea why. Why do I have to eat this green stuff when there's this pile of cookies over here? Okay, pretty soon you'll understand enough that we'll explain why, and we may still not let it be your choice for a while. But yeah, the mindset is worlds different, even though in both cases, the parents have to exercise a certain amount of control because, I mean, the baby will just starve together.
I'm going to be difficult now, if you don't mind.
Good.
But throughout the conversation, you've spoken about rights. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, rights only exist within the context of the state.
No. I would say that's usually where the term is used. To me, rights are completely a negative concept. All they mean is, here's a thing that if I do it, nobody else should violently interfere with me.
Okay.
Government or anybody else.
Well, hold on. Let me give an example.
When you talk about political,
let me jump in. Let me give an example to make it easier to understand where I'm going with this. Just picture an island, and you've got three kids or three adults that end up on this island. There's no government, nothing, and one of them says, "It's my right." Now, it doesn't matter if they say that because there's only three of them on the island.
Well, it's just a description of, it's a moral description of a negative. If one of them says, I have the right to say stupid things, all it means is it's wrong for somebody else to violently stop me from saying stupid things.
Okay, I got you.
So it's just a negative. Now, in most cases, that's used in the context of political stuff because government is the thing that violently dominates people way more than anything else. But the idea of, like, the right to freedom of speech, all that means is if I'm saying what I think, nobody should, like, punch me out and forcibly silence me for saying what I think on my property. Now, if I'm trespassing, they can say, go say what you think on your own property. It doesn't mean anybody has to give me a microphone or a stage, or doesn't mean anybody has to listen. It's a purely negative thing that violence shouldn't be used against me just because I did X. To me, that's all a right is. Yeah. Is if I do this, it doesn't make it okay for you to use violence against me. Like, be the right to be armed. Like, it's not okay for you to use violence against me just because I have a gun. Like, if I threaten you, that's a different thing. And so it's a negative thing. But a lot of people sort of think of it in terms of, well, we have this list of things that for some reason we're allowed to do, as if that comes from government. And yeah, that's not what it is.
So ultimately, what you're suggesting, Larkin, is that society can self-order itself through voluntary interactions and mutual consent. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, it's a good summary. And I think most people, that's already how they function in their daily lives anyway. They've just been taught that there's an exception for this monstrosity called government. Because, like, if somebody goes to a store to buy lunch, everybody there is there by choice. The checkout people and the manager and the customers and the people stocking the shelves. And, like, everybody is there because, okay, somebody else offered to pay me money if I do this. And the customers come in because they say, well, they said if I give them this money, they'll give me that food. So it's an example of a very intricate anarchy in action, because there's nobody forcing anybody to do any of that. Nobody's forcing anybody to feed anybody in the U.S. So it's very intricate. It's very sophisticated. It's very effective. And there is no authority involved. There's owners who say, if you work here, here's the job you have to do. And if you don't, we fire you. We're not going to conscript worker. Force people to work here. The most we can do is force people to leave because you're on our property and you're not doing what you said you would if we paid you, so you're fired. And the worker has the same right, which is, I don't want to do this anymore, I'm leaving. It's just ending a consensual trade agreement. And so people already have hundreds of examples of anarchy in action in their daily lives, and they just don't notice how much of their life is already people doing things voluntarily, organizing and cooperating voluntarily. They've just been taught that, well, some things are so big, we need this giant parasitic thing that has the right to rob us and boss us around to protect us and to help the poor and stuff. But most people already know how to live like anarchists.
Larkin, there are examples, though, where this has not worked out well. Ancient Iceland is one of those examples where the Nordics, Vikings, whatever, they colonized. And I think it's around 700 or 800 years, they were fairly anarchist. There was no ruling class as such. But they forgot to build any type of defenses. And when the British Empire went across, they just went in and took over without any issues.
Yeah. And the thing is, there's still the practical considerations. The main thing that makes that a lot less of an issue is the invention of firearms. And the fact True. That a normal person can now kill somebody from 200 yards away before the other person even knows they're there. And it may sound like sort of a, you know, random little detail, but that is huge. If you're an invading army and the other people have swords, it's like, well, how many? Okay, we have 500 of us. We're going into their village where they have 50 people. Well, this will be easy. Like, violent domination works. It's sort of like, you know, I believe in self-ownership. If 10 violent thugs break into the house of one little old lady, they're probably going to steal her shit and they might kill her. And she doesn't necessarily have a way to stop that. It's not that justice always happens in the absence of a ruling class, but it is injustice always happens with the presence of a ruling class, because it's always the biggest thug and thief around. And so, yeah, there are definitely times when a bigger status gang of thugs can, you know, bully its way and force its will on, you know, a smaller group of victims. But yeah, the advent of the firearm did tons to change that. One of the videos I want to get around to finishing is, it's actually for all the people who go, well, if we didn't have a government, we'd be invaded by China or whatever, as in the U.S. getting invaded. And the video is actually from the perspective of, okay, you're now like the top general of this invading army, China, Russia, whatever, pick your favorite country to invade us. You're the general coming in to take over the U.S. And the first thing you hear is, okay, there were 100 million gun owners the day you came in. The next day, because each of those had three guns and loaned them to their neighbors, now there's 300 million gun owners. So there you are trying to take over this place. And this is if there's no ruling class, like if the U.S. ruling class, you know, people in the U.S. stop believing in government. What you as the invading general know, none of them believe in an authority. None of them believe in any obligation to obey anybody, especially not you, a foreign invader. None of them has the ability to surrender on behalf of anybody else, which means you need to get 300 million people to surrender one at a time. Now, I'm sure you can drive a tank into a town, kill a bunch of people. But here's this other thing. 100 million of them can kill you way before you know they're there. And your tank drivers, unless your tank drivers are living in their tanks, sooner or later, they have to come out. They have to come out to take a shit. And if there's somebody with, like, I have a Savage 308 rifle. If there's somebody with one of those within 200 yards of you, you're dead. And none of them will have any qualms about killing you or your tank drivers or your pilots or anybody else the moment you set foot in the open. So how are you going to get 300 million armed people, at least 100 million of whom are actually good at using firearms already, good enough to shoot your thugs? How are you going to get them to surrender and let you rule over them? And the answer is, you're not. You can kill a bunch of them if you have enough bombs and stuff. And then compare that to, like, France in World War II, where, you know, Third Reich rolls in and immediately a bunch of the French government goes, well, hey, invading army, if we kiss your ass, can we stay in power? And then you get the Vichy government.
No, but that's government. Because they're French.
Bunch of collaborators. Yeah.
Nobody likes the frogs.
It may be the worst case
Nobody
scenario.
Likes the frogs, let's be honest.
Right. But still, if somebody invades here and the U.S. government goes, oh, we give up, a lot of people go, well, I guess we give up. No, a lot still wouldn't. But there's no advantage to having, like, a centralized group that claims to speak on behalf of the people. Even like Afghanistan, where the U.S. and the Soviet Union kept invading and a bunch of goat herders with rusty AKs held them off for decades. Held off two superpowers. And it, you know, regardless of the morality of who was doing what, if you're in a place where the normal people are armed and feel justified shooting at you, you're never safe there. You can't conquer them if they have the mindset of, we have the right to defend ourselves, you're not our rightful anything, and we're going to shoot you the first chance we get. And here's the thing that would probably get censored if this was on YouTube. One of the most effective versions of national defense, the most moral, cost-effective, and efficient versions, is assassination. What did the UN do? If there's an army, okay, we all agree you don't target the people who made this war happen. You just let them kill each other's pawns forever. Well, if somebody says, I'm sending in my army, all right, let's have a bake sale to raise $1 million for whoever brings back that guy's head because he just admitted he's invading. Oh, he died. And his successor suddenly isn't that eager to invade us because he knows it isn't just his pawns that are going to die. We're going to hunt him down because he's the one who caused it. And notice governments never do that. Well, sometimes they do sort of subtly, like the CIA will knock off somebody in Central America and pretend they didn't.
There's also a logical consistency to what you're saying because, hang on. Let me just quickly, before I get to that, you were talking about invading a country, but if there's no ruling class, there isn't a country, if you think about it. It's like a region or an area. But there is a logical consistency, and that is if people stopped believing in government, higher up, sort of darker systems like central banks and all that sort of thing, they would also fail to exist because they exist with that alignment with governments.
Yeah. And the like people point at the Federal Reserve in this country, you know, there's the equivalent all over the place, the private, not private government, authoritarian BS currency system. And they go, well, what about them? They're all powerful. No, they're not. Right now, if you say, I made a different currency, want to use this, government thugs show up to shut you down. And that's happened a few times when people like tried to make silver coins and you use the word dollar on it. So now we're going to send in the feds to raid you. If you don't have a ruling class, the banking institutions are nothing. Like, okay, you can have your crappy currency that goes down in value every week. We're going to use something else. What are you going to do about it? And so, yeah, a lot of those things that, there's a lot of actual conspiracies, like the currency system is obviously a conspiracy. It was designed to exploit the work of humanity and basically enslave them to the bankers. And for a long time, I thought, oh, people need to understand this and they need to understand that. And they don't. If people didn't believe in authority, they could just go, well, I could use this dollar that those guys print and it goes down in value every 5 seconds. Or I could use Bitcoin or silver or this other currency or that other currency or whatever. And they may fluctuate and stuff. All of their conspiracies fall apart if you pull the plug, which is the belief in authority. Because without their ability to make people go along with their crappy ideas, yeah, some people will fall for a scam here and there and go, oh, I got all excited about that, but that was dumb. Never mind. But without people believing in an obligation to obey the law, you can't legalize your crappy ideas and make people think they have to go along with it, unlike like what the Federal Reserve does. People think, well, you're not allowed to do this. And then what do you mean not allowed to? I mean, some political crook scribbled that you have to use this crappy currency. And you have to accept that crappy currency, and you're not allowed to have competing currencies to this crappy currency. And so, and it's the same thing with all the warmongering games. If people didn't feel obliged to pay their taxes, it's like, well, we're going to start a war over here. Funded by what? You guys have to pay us. No, we don't. We don't really want war. We want to be protected, but we don't want what you psychos are doing. If there isn't a government there to rob everybody to fund it, there goes the war.
That's the other thing. If you actually think about it, every single war is started by the government. Israel going into Gaza, that's a governmental decision with its own military. Where Russia going to Ukraine, doesn't matter which war you think of, it's always the government. I can't think of a war that was started with, you know, the peasant class.
Yeah. Hermann Göring, who is he was the head of the Luftwaffe. He was one of the top brass under Hitler. And he explained, like, why would the normal people ever want to go to war? Like, they have everything to lose and nothing to gain. They just want to mind their own business and do this thing. So you have to play these games where you accuse them of, like, lack of patriotism if you don't, like, jump in this tank and drive over to some other country to kill some people. People are not naturally warring anymore. I mean, once upon a time, humanity was such that we kind of had no moral codes and was like, oh, yeah, you can kill that other tribe and steal their stuff. That's perfectly fine. Thankfully, humanity seems to have progressed from that. And now they have to use a bunch of manipulation and propaganda and stuff to trick people into running off to war. Because, yeah, normal people have no incentive to do that, even if they think they're going to win. It's like, if I can live my life here, why would I go to some other country and risk getting killed because I might get a slightly better piece of land or something? Like, that doesn't at all sound worth it. So, yeah, all of the fear-mongering and the divide and conquer. And it's all on both sides, too. Like, both sides of every war between governments, both sides always suck. They don't always suck to the same degree, but like World War II, the Allies did heinous war crimes of firebombing Dresden and Tokyo and the nuking of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, which were not really good military targets. And so in any war, if you're picking sides between wars between governments, you're picking a bad side. It may not quite be as bad as the other side, but it's still a bad side. But the reason the founders of the U.S. said the best form of national defense is actually a militia, like the normal people being armed, is because they know the normal people being armed, they are not eager to leave their families to run off and have a shootout with somebody. It has to get pretty bad before they do that. So you can't just trick them into, oh, good, let's go have a war and get shot at again. And once they do it, their primary goal is end the threat and go home. That's what moral people want. If there's an actual danger and a threat, whether it's your house or your town or an invading army, end the threat, go just shoot at the people who are actually invading, not randomly bomb villages that happen to be in the same country as them. Actually shoot the aggressors so we can go home. And the founders described, like, that's why we want militia to be the main form of defense, because normal people and their normal moral codes, they don't want to run off and have mortal combat unless they have to. And if they have to, they want to do it, get it done, and go home and not like blow up a bunch of civilians for years and all that insanity. And so, of course, the U.S. ignored that and made a standing army anyway.
I didn't want to bring this up, but I'm going to bring it up because it invariably comes up in comments or in conversation. And I've had this conversation for years, but I haven't had it with you. So, and that is, but okay. Larkin, who will build the roads?
The funniest thing for me is I literally just made a road. It's only a dirt road. I literally just made a half mile loop road on property up in Northern Arizona for a friend of mine. So now my answer is me. I'll make all of them all by myself. But things like that are, again, if people are used to having the government do something, they sort of think, well, I haven't seen anybody else do it. So how does that work?
The government doesn't do it, though. That's what they don't get. The government outsources that.
Yeah, they already don't do it. You're not seeing a congressman out there like running a bulldozer, making a road. Mm-hmm. They just steal a bunch of money, waste most of it, and then usually pay their cousin who does a crappy job to make a road that falls apart in 2 years. But if people sort of think of government as, well, it has abilities that we don't, and ignores the fact that we collectively, we're still the ones who do it. The people out there making roads and maintaining it and building bridges, like the ones who design it, the ones who make the concrete, the ones who make the huge machinery, the ones who run the machinery, none of those are government. None of those are Congress. None of those are tax collectors. So the only role that government did was steal a bunch of our money and waste a bunch of it and then give it back to the people that we could have given it to ourselves to begin with. But it's one of those things, like I often point out, like in the Soviet Union, where the ruling class is the source of your food. Like you get your one half a loaf of moldy bread per month or whatever it was, and you have to stand in line for hours. If somebody comes along and says government shouldn't exist, it's not logical, but it's sort of natural for those people to go, well, who's going to feed us? And they don't realize the reason you're starving to death is because of the government that you're now standing in line for. But if that's all they've ever seen, and if people have, like, we're used to government doing the police, so we're not sure what it would look like. We're used to government doing the roads, so we're not sure what it would look like. The more things that government can run so that people can't quite imagine how it would work without it, the more people are scared into cheering for authoritarianism. Even in the U.S., the vast majority of roads for a very long time were all private. It wasn't a government thing. And then the interstate system happened, which is huge. But the idea that, and I mockingly refer to it as the idea that normal people can't make a flat place. Really? You think without politicians and tax, because a road is a flat place. It's a flat place where you can drive from here to there. You think we couldn't do that without political parasites? But again, it's a thing of growing up.
I live in Africa, right? I can tell you, the government is not very good at doing anything.
Yeah, they suck.
And when
they suck at almost everything.
And before someone says Africa's not a country because I made it sound like that, the entire continent, no government right. on the entire continent is very good at doing anything.
Right. And it's funny, there's a little town I grew up in, and I think two of the roads are still, they were privately funded and built. They're only maybe half mile long each, and they have a bunch of houses on them. They were privately built and privately maintained for a long time. I'm not sure if they still are. And they lasted the longest of any roads, because when people are actually paying for something, one of their first thoughts is, well, are we going to have to do this again in 5 minutes? Like, can we build it so we don't have to pay for it again? And when government does it, so all the government roads in the same town get potholes in 5 seconds, because their thought is, if our department wants to get the same amount of funding next year, this shit better be falling apart, because we already built the roads. We need something to do next year. We're going to design it so that it falls apart so that we can ask for more funding next year. If the customer is actually paying for what he gets, the customer has an incentive to try to get what actually serves his needs. If it's government, they force you to pay for it either way. They don't give a crap if it serves you. And you can complain and whine, these roads are bad. What do they care? And then they're giving their deal to their cousin and this and that and the other thing. They aren't punished by doing a crappy job, which is like why you said they're bad at everything. Why wouldn't they be? You can't fire them. If they force you to fund whatever stupid, inefficient crap they do, what's the incentive to do a good job? Whereas in private industry, if somebody says, hey, I make roads and he makes a crappy road, everybody goes, okay, never hire him again. He can't tax you. He can just go, oh, whoops. And then the guy who knows how to make a good road, he gets everybody's business. So it's a self-correcting thing. But even economics that simple, most people don't think of, well, we need government to do this. Well, have you ever wondered why they're so bad at absolutely everything? Because they have zero incentive. Imagine if your job was you get paid this amount, whether you do anything for any of the customers or not.
And I mean, if you think about it, if you gave up your belief in government, you wouldn't even have the UN, because the UN exists because of governments.
Yeah. It's so weird. Like, once you're outside of the box of statism and you're not thinking those terms, so much of it is just immediately apparently insane. So you have a bunch of ruling classes and they go to war with each other. Then you're like, well, this is why we need another ruling class that tells the ruling classes to be nice to each other. Oops, that took a side. Okay, now we need another ruling class to tell, like, you keep trying to set up these authorities to have the one at the top be the good guys. And it never is. Well, then we need one above that. We need a committee to look into that. Like, there's no amount of arranging authoritarian power that's suddenly going to make it a benevolent thing. It's still going to be parasites top to bottom. And yet people, well, we need checks and balances. Like, we have this group of crooks and that group of crooks. Maybe we can make the group of crooks, like, try to not make the other group of crooks quite as bad. It's like giving two people permission to beat you up and saying, by the way, will each of you try to keep the other one from beating me up too much? Why would anyone think that's a rational approach? And yet that's the political system of almost every country in the world.
I'm reminded of that saying from Milton Friedman, something along the lines of, if you put the government in charge of the Sahara Desert, in 5 years' time, there'll be a shortage of sand.
Yeah, and there would be. I don't know how they'd achieve it, but their ability to botch things up is unparalleled. And it's just amazing. People want government doing things that they want. And they don't even think far enough to say, you just gave someone power over you. Why do you think they're going to care what you want anymore? You're not their customer anymore. You're their subject. You put them on the throne. You gave them power. And then you whine when they don't do what you want. You're basically a slave who said, you own me. Now, here's what I want. And the slave master said, I don't care what you want. And you're like all offended. Why would you be offended or surprised that you put someone in power over you and they no longer give a crap what you want. You put them there. Stop putting them there.
How can, well, not me, but how can other people get your book or other work at least?
This, I have one too, is available on Amazon. I sort of resent Amazon. I think it's about to be available in more countries. It's available in the US and in the UK, and other people sometimes buy cases and have it. So there's also the ebook and the audiobook on Amazon that I think you can get from anywhere in the world. This, which is the novel version of Jones Plantation, can be had at thejonesplantationbook.com, and Amazon Prime, you can now see Jones Plantation on. My YouTube channel, which is just YouTube/LarkinRose, has 80 bazillion free videos on it about all sorts of this fun stuff. And then for people already on board, we have something called The Rose Channel, which is therosechannel.com for people who already understand these things. And we have a course on how to talk to other people about it and things like that. And so there's stuff all over the place.
Lock and Rose, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.